This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
The Islamic economy is a multi-trillion business covering the needs of at least one-seventh of the world's population. Here to tell us more about the challenges and opportunities of the Islamic economy is Professor Aslam Hanif. Professor Aslam is currently a professor at the Department of Economics at the International Islamic University Malaysia, or IIUM. But more importantly, he is also the director for the Center of Islamic Economics of the same university, IIUM. If you have any questions for Professor Aslam, or if you want to know more about the realm of Islamic economy, you can text us at 016-201-9000 or tweet us at BFM Radio. We'll be taking your questions live this morning. Welcome to the show, Professor.
Thank you very much, Ibrahim. Thank you for having me.
Now, of course, we start off with the news that a few weeks ago, the Minister of Finance and the Ministry of Finance, as well as the Minister of Finance, have introduced a slew of activities and initiatives to actually improve and boost the so-called Islamic economy. One of the ways that they want to do this is on strengthening Wakaf programs, and they feel that this could be a key area to actually improve on the Islamic economy. Number one, what do you think is the whole greater agenda of this initiative? And number two, do you think Wakaf is the right tool to actually boost Islamic economy?
Thank you, Ibrahim. Firstly, I think we need to see the development of Islamic economics in the last 40 years as being something that has come out of a demand from Muslim societies that want to run their economic affairs in line with the religious principles and beliefs. And I think, rightly so, the government has answered this and has been very supportive of many of the economic reforms that we see in the country today. One of these areas, of course, is Wakaf. Historically, it has played a very big role in Islamic civilization. Especially, documents are available from the Ottoman period in which we see Awqaf or charitable endowments in almost every sphere of life. Education, health, even certain recreational activities. So this idea of seeing Wakaf as a third sector, a complementary third sector to the private and public sectors, is really what Islamic economics is all about. An Islamic economy is really a three-sector economy with this voluntary sector or Awqaf playing a very big role.
Now, of course, a lot of focus have been placed on the improvement and development of Islamic finance, and therefore Islamic banking comes into this ambit. But, you know, Islamic economy is far larger than that. There's halal travel, there's modest fashion, there's even Islamic media and recreation, cosmetics, halal business. Do you think that an overemphasis has been placed on Islamic finance and not much of these other areas over the past few decades?
You're really spot on, Ibrahim. I mean, you know, we in the Department of Economics and the Kulia of Economics and Management Sciences in IIUM, we've been trying to present Islamic finance as being an integral part of an Islamic economic system. The practice, however, over the last maybe 30 years, we see that Islamic banking especially has become so dominant. There has been a legitimate need to have financing activities which are in line with the Sharia. And so we understand this. But I think there is really a need for us to relook at how Islamic finance must be seen as part of an economic system. So you can't have a financial system that does not participate and help to achieve the economic and social objectives of society. And certainly, it's not all about profits. There must be social responsibility, there must be equity, there must be justice, which needs to be also achieved by the financial system.
Much of the critique that has come towards the academia world is on the fact that much of the proposals are not commercially viable. Now, in the world of commercialization as well as trying to make the more profit-oriented businesses, you can't escape that commercialization is a key element in executing initiatives. Do you think that there's an overemphasis on making profit on Islamic businesses like Islamic banking, and therefore you don't see the businesses of halal economy or Islamic economy growing because of that commercial element not being there?
The idea of making profits, there is really nothing wrong with this. In fact, it's part of, you know, what you need to do as a businessman and even as any individual. Your aim is to earn a profit. The issue now becomes what elements go into making that profit. And secondly, how you view profit. Is it profit just for the individual, or is it a profit in which society also benefits? So with this emphasis, then your Islamic economic solution will be that when you make decisions, it has to be made with society in mind.
Mm-hmm.
And I think theoretically, this is where we are still debating after the last 25, 30 years. We are still debating about how businesses are supposed to make their decisions. Is it just purely on the company's profit itself, or is there some element of giving back? And it's not very far away, because you see, even in modern economic discussions today, corporate social responsibility issues, acts of altruism, these are all now getting into the discourse in economics and finance. So what we have in Islamic economics is just trying to bring something that we have from our wisdom of revelation into a modern discipline of economics and finance.
Okay, let's put theory into practice. Right now, microfinance has been touted as something that is good for the economy, good for the community. We've seen institutions like the Grameen Bank in Bangladesh being introduced by Professor Yunus, a Nobel laureate, mind you, has apparently helped the communities in Bangladesh. But we cannot escape the fact that they do charge a very high profit rate, 40% in some instances, over 100% in other instances. Now, where do you see microfinance charging 50% or 60% interest rate? And how does that help the community at the end of the day?
Well, we first have to go back and see why microfinance, or what is sometimes called social banking, or social finance, has come into play. It's because the previous banking system was seen to be a banking system that did not take care of this huge percentage of the world's population. So, people like Muhammad Yunus, they saw a problem in which you had what is called unbankable poor, which commercial banks were not going into. So you had this need to come up with an alternative banking institution, so hence social banking. The fact that social banking gives out small amounts of loans makes their costs relatively high, right? So what we've been trying to do in Islamic economics is, how can we integrate other institutions that we have, like Waqaf, like Awqaf, how can we integrate these institutions with microfinance? Hence, with funding from Awqaf institutions, they can actually bring down the costs of microfinance loans.
So this comes into the question of regulation and how permissible it is to carry out these kind of activities within the law. In Malaysia, to carry out a Waqaf initiative, it's actually quite restrictive. The government has clearly outlined ways of doing it. Do you think that laws in this instance is actually prohibitive to do or to flourish that industry even further?
Well, when you talk about the third sector in Malaysia, we will also have to distinguish between activities that will come under trusts and endowments and those which come under Waqaf. When it comes to Waqaf, Malaysian law is maybe quite unique in the sense that it goes to the state Islamic religious councils. And I think if the federal government is going to see Waqaf playing a bigger role, and they are already, because there are quite a lot of emphasis given to Waqaf and higher education, for example, there will be a need for the federal government to actually come up with regulatory frameworks, governance frameworks, and best practices in investment, in management, in accounting, if they want to see Waqaf play an effective role in society, because or else we're not going to get the impact of Waqaf in mainstream society.
So therefore, this big question of rethinking the Islamic economics and finance is brought into the picture. Do you think there is a crucial need for us to have a rethink on how we do things for Islamic economy?
Any academic discipline, and for that matter, any issue that requires solutions, has to always be rethinking itself. Yeah? when Islamic economics, contemporary Islamic economics began maybe 40, 50 years ago in a big way, there was a certain vision about what we wanted to achieve. And some people have even used the word, it was an Islamic economics movement. This has now, over the decades, become dominated by an Islamic banking industry, very, very corporate-like. And it played a role. But I think now, as we, you know, we move on, there is a need to relook. Hence, you know, rethinking where we are and where we want to go and how to get there, I think is very crucial for the survival of Islamic economics and finance.
This morning, I'm speaking with Professor Aslam Hanif, Director of the Center for Islamic Economics International Islamic University in Malaysia. Up next, we'll be asking him on whether or not Islamic finance actually polarizes the country even further. This is BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, this morning on The Breakfast Grill is Professor Aslam Hanif, Director of the Centre for Islamic Economics, IIUM. We are discussing the concept of the Islamic economics per se. My question to you, Professor, is that while Islamic economy is actually quite needed, in fact, it is part of the mandatory requirement within the Sharia law, the question is, the country, particularly a multicultural country like Malaysia, do you think that this kind of initiatives actually polarizes the country even further? How does this add to that national unity agenda that the government wants?
Thank you, Ibrahim. You know, in Islamic economics, in the field of economics, business, I think we are really very, very much religion and ethnic race neutral. The basis of Islamic economics is that we want to achieve justice. We call not only for efforts to grow, but also to distribute that growth equitably. I think in the case of Malaysia, the reforms that have happened in Islamic economics and Islamic finance have actually been shown to be across all ethnic groups, all religions. There are many banks, for example, I'm told, the clientele is even more non-Muslim than they are Muslim. So at the end of the day, I think if you want to talk about Islamic reforms, then certainly Islamic economic reforms is probably the least problematic because it deals with people's livelihood. But now, dealing with livelihood in an ethical and just way.
Okay, Prof, I don't think anyone can disagree with you on trying to make things more equitable and achieve justice. But actually, the implementation of these kind of things actually create that kind of racial disharmony. For instance, there is now a movement to say that you need to have two halal stamps, one from JAKIM or some other halal body, the other one to say, another new stamp is trying to say, you know, it's made by Muslims. You know, these kind of things, right, they mask themselves within the notion of Islamic finance or Islamic economy. But at the end of the day, it does provoke that kind of sentiment where it becomes a little bit more polarized. How do you square the gap between the noble intentions of Islamic finance with the practical decisions that, you know, the everyday Malaysians take?
Well, when it comes to the halal certification, I think this is something which is globally acceptable. You have kosher, you know, labels. You have vegetarian labels. You have halal label, which I think is an important part of what a Muslim would look for when he or she is buying. However, you may have other labeling which may not achieve targets of being global. Yeah? And I think it's really very important that authorities think carefully about what kind of labeling they are going to allow in the country so that we do not have unnecessary divisions in society. I have really no idea what the intention was behind this idea of putting a Muslims, made by Muslims logo. But I just hope that the authorities would, you know, would and not only the authorities, but even the society at large, relooks at the reasons of having these labels.
Prof, I think this question is directly affecting your domain. There's a tweet coming in asking, national unity actually comes from good education. Is Islamic economy covering Islamic education? And if so, how does this add national unity?
Well, I can speak for the International Islamic University of Malaysia, and particularly in economics. You know, what we've been trying to do for the last 33 years in the IIUM, you know, is an idea of education that goes back centuries. And that is education, which is to create good people who hopefully will then become good citizens. Yeah? But good people, good human beings, this is what the aim is, can be achieved by integrating the teachings that are revealed in religion with the modern knowledge that has been developing over the last centuries, yeah? Which, by the way, is predominantly coming from the Western European experience. So the idea of Islamic economics as a discipline is to interact critically with bodies of knowledge that are there so that you can actually provide a better alternative. And economics, I think, is one of those areas in which Islamic economics, Islamic finance has shown that it is more just than, say, current banking systems, which, you know, you talk about the recurring financial crisis happening. Islamic economics is saying if you have certain features in your financial system, you would have a more stable financial system.
So do you agree with the statement that Islamic economy and finance actually brings a greater level of financial stability towards the global financial economy?
It has been empirically proven, you know, that a system in which risks are not just transferred and just dumped on other people, where you share risk. And this is what, you know, an Islamic system is all about, sharing risk. Mm-hmm. And the benefits that come from sharing risk.
Which moves my question quite nicely. Based on my conversations with some of the Islamic bank CEOs, including the CEO of CIMB Islamic, including the CEO of Maybank Islamic on the Breakfast Grill, they have a little bit of a hesitancy in trying to roll out this risk-sharing products. While at the end of the day, they have to do it because the regulators forces them to, in a way. That's not the go-to or first method of doing business for them. Do you think there is a non-commercial argument for introducing risk-sharing products, particularly in the world of Islamic finance, not necessarily Islamic economy?
Well, again, I think you correctly put it. I mean, we're talking about, you know, two different things. One, you talk about banks, and then you talk about finance. Banks are one form of financial institutions. And if you're talking about commercial banks, then commercial banks work on a certain premise and a certain mode. It may be possible that certain modes which require equity participation may not be what commercial banks are going to be going into. No. But we can have alternative banks and financial institutions.
So, which points it nicely, there's a question coming in through SMS arguing on the creation or improving or enlarging the role of Takaful and other finance institutions, not necessarily banking institution, but finance institution. Do you see this as an imperative movement for us to do?
I think any financial system, even conventional financial system, has got all these institutions. It's just that I think maybe in Malaysia and in many other countries, banks play a very central role. I think I was just telling you outside just mm-hmm. now that, you know, maybe we inherited the UK system in which the only holidays you have are bank holidays, you know. and so the bank plays such an important role. When the bank closes, everybody is on holiday.
Yeah.
But certainly in a financial system, it's not just banks, right? So you've got the whole spectrum of institutions. And I think in that context, we can have a place for institutions that are going to look at these equity participation type of financing
kind of involvement.
Yeah, more.
Yeah. Right. From the theme that you speak of, Islamic finance and Islamic economy in general is quite universal. There is a question coming in from Azhar Naseh. Azhar is asking, why is it that Islamic economy can be acceptable by non-Muslims, but not in the case of Islamic law or Islamic hudud? Why do we draw the line between economic participation for all and Islamic law for some?
Well, you know, Islamic law is really an area that is beyond, you know, what I'm going to talk about. But I think that looking at what has been going on for the last 30, 40 years in Malaysia, what is clear is that whatever reforms that have been done in the sphere of economics, in the sphere of finance, has been an all-inclusive reform. there has not been a problem. Islamic law, I suppose, especially in those areas that you talked about, these are probably more sensitive areas. And from what I gather, the idea is because some of these requirements are requirements in the Sharia, there are Muslims who feel that Muslims should be able to practice those, you know, those laws. But that has not been the system in Malaysia historically. And so there is maybe some tension there. That's why I will say, you know, the way to go is economics and finance, where really there isn't, as far as I know, there isn't really any problem that anyone would have with what we want to do.
This morning I'm speaking with Professor Aslam Hanif, Director of the Center for Islamic Economics, IIUM. Professor, let's cross the bridge between academia and real-life requirement. Do you think that the academics are providing the necessary resources to bridge the gap needed in making Islamic economy work?
This is a very important point, Ibrahim. And I have to say that, you know, being an academic and being in the academic world, sometimes we get very, very frustrated because you may have wonderful models and wonderful ideas, and then when it comes to the implementation part, you get stuck. Yeah? And I think that's one of the big challenges. So if you're talking about how we are going to translate these ideals into realities, it has to be something that gets the support of all parties. I'm talking about academia, practitioners in the industry, as well as the regulators, the government, and even for that matter, you know, the society at large. So it can't be just something that is going to be done in classrooms. It must be translated. And that's why we need the support of all parties.
Now, a lot of non-Muslim academics are making comments on Islamic finance. One of them is, of course, Professor Steve Keane, who is slated to come on The Breakfast Grill this week. He is head of the School of Economics at Kingston University. And he has a few very constructive words for the world of Islamic finance. This kind of discussion is kind of important for us to have. Do we have a platform for us to continue on this conversation at the commercial level or at the public level? Can public actually learn more and contribute towards the development of Islamic economics and finance?
I mean, Steve Keane brings in a very important alternative view. He is also very critical of mainstream economics and finance. And I think that is also where Islamic economics is coming from. We do not want Islamic economics and finance to be seen as just a replica of the mainstream conventional. And so, his contribution would be to give insights on what are those criticisms of mainstream coming from other academics based in the West. And I think we'll have a lot of similarities that we can benefit from. And we could also learn. And that will help develop Islamic economics and finance.
Is there an event that we can actually look forward to?
Well, we are, after for the next 3 days, we are in the IIUM together with our partners, the Islamic Research and Training Institute of the IDB, as well as the International Association of Islamic Economics. We are organizing the 11th International Conference of Islamic Economics and Finance. It has a long tradition, a 40-year tradition. In fact, 1976 saw the first conference in Makkah, and it was really the place which many consider to be the birthplace of contemporary Islamic economics as a discipline. So we are honored to be the host. It's the second time that IIUM, the Kulia of Economics and Management Sciences, is hosting this. The first time was in 1992, and we are hosting it again. And we have about 100, more than 100 papers being presented, talking about various dimensions on the theme of rethinking Islamic economics and finance, moving towards inclusive and sustainable development. I think a theme which is very important for us today.
And do you think Malaysia has a competitive advantage in actually kicking this off over other Muslim countries?
Malaysia has been leading, if not the leader, in many areas in Islamic economic and finance reforms. And we hope that this conference, which, by the way, is getting the full support of the Ministry of Finance, who is our strategic partner, we hope we'll be able to translate some of those discussions and to bridge the gaps between academics, practitioners and regulators.
This morning, I spoke to Professor Aslam Hanif, the professor of the Department of Economics at the International Islamic University Malaysia. He is also the director of the Center for Islamic Economics, IIUM. Prof, thanks for coming on The Grill.
Thank you very much, Ibrahim, for having me.
I am Ibrahim Sani for BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.